and it was frightening. It really was frightening.
Like Russian roulette.
Yeah, it was. It was. And that, again, is one of the reasons why so many were killed.
But no radio in...
No. You had communication in the airplane, but no ground air. No ground air. It was all done by Aldous lamp. And when you went off across country, the only thing you had to help you with navigation was that you were given the beacons. Every airfield had a beacon on it, a flashing beacon, mm-hmm. with a code, normally one letter code or sometimes two. And all you were given was the beacon call sign. And then there were radio beacons around the country. Mm. That you could home in on if you had to, because by this time we had been given enough. We had radio compasses, and not radio compasses, but direction finding equipment in the airplane, so you could home in on a beacon. Mm. So your navigation was really a combination of airfield beacons mm-hmm. and radio beacons, mm-hmm. and that was it. Now by this time, of course, we were beginning to get crewed up too, because we were starting to have navigators coming into the crew. It wasn't just a pilot, two pilots. Now we have to start to put a crew together.
Oh, I see.
Purely simply for training purposes. There was no idea of going on as a crew because the crews were broken up, but it was beginning to bring people together mm-hmm. so that you'd begin to work as a crew. When we got to that cross country stage, terrible. When you think back of it.
One thing you haven't mentioned about your training at this particular point, now it might come later, and that is any bombing training.
Yes, bombing, yes. Some of the exercises were, no, by George, I don't have any bombing. No, there was no bombing training at that OTU. I don't recollect any bombing training, mm-hmm. because up to this moment, I suppose the big thing was to get to know the airplane, flying in an entirely different environment to flying in Canada, literally becoming acclimatized. And mm-hmm. and remember, the flying times were terrible. I finished SFTS with a total of 133 hours. In other words, I went overseas with a total of 133 hours. And by the time I'd finished that OTU, I had 161 hours. So you see, I'm less than 30 hours flying in on the Whitleys. Now I'm ready for operation with 161 total flying time, to my credit.
Well, now again, before we have you leaving the training squadron, what about the danger of being zapped by some of the German fighters?
Yes, if there were any intruders, we were called down. Or if you were on a cross country, just too bad. If you were out in the cross country, just waiting. But I must admit, the Germans had not reached the stage of doing real intruder work. That came a little bit later in the war, when they would come over and try and sit over the airfields. Fortunately, they didn't come in early in the war, and I refer to that as being early in the war, because the bomber command effort, and in fact, we weren't very much beyond at this stage of the game, the phony war and the Battle of Britain. And so the thing said, bomber command was very small, it was still trying to get off the ground. The whole of Britain was literally waiting for the invasion, so to speak. Yeah. It was still that... I can still remember the briefings that, now if the invasion comes, even though the Battle of Britain was over and that sort of thing, there was still very much of a fear of an invasion, even in that time.
Yeah. Now this would be the summer of 41.
That's right. Now. Yes, we're talking about summer 41. Yeah. That's right. And the great fear of what to do, all the airfields, all the big open fields had either stakes in them or vehicles or something like that. All the road signs had gone, so that if they did come, they wouldn't know where the hell they were.
Yeah, little pillboxes at the crossroads.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Very much of a, and roadblocks every once in a while too that had been put up. But it was very much of an invasion phobia. Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
Now, any intruders that did come in were more likely to be bomber airplanes, and the airfield would literally close down. That's what would happen. Mm-hmm. Rather than the matter of intruders coming in to shoot down airplanes.
Well, now, again, at the at this training level where you are, is this all Canadian?
No. As a matter of fact, the crew was, the course was made up of quite a conglomeration of people. As a matter of fact, I can't remember. I think there were about, let's see, there's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. Well, I can see right away at least 12 RAF boys, two Australians, and two Canadians.
Ah, I see. Course.
They were mainly RAF.
Yeah. Well, how did you get along with them on a personal basis, Ray?
Oh, fine. Yep, fine. I never had any, with the exception of that one character that I had trouble with who disappeared. No, I always got along very, very well with the RAF. Mm-hmm. Extremely well. I never had any trouble. Mm-hmm. We were all in the same boat. All these people in the course were doing exactly the same thing I were doing. They didn't have much experience, and they were trying to learn how to fly to us what was a bloody big airplane.
Was there any kidding about the Canadian colonial?
No, not then. No, not then. That came a little later. That came a little later when you ran into squadron commanders.
Yeah.
Or particularly a squadron commander who was an old-time RAF man who was full of wind and vinegar. And he would make the odd caustic remark like that. But in the main, I never... there may be the odd joshing in a pub. But that was easy, because then, of course, you probably started because you'd call them bloody limeys or something like that. So it was a give-and-take situation in a good jocular fashion.
Yeah.
No, it was never... No, I never had any trouble with the RAF.
Any bitter feeling or anything of that nature? Well, not bitter feeling, but any feeling about the difference in pay?
No. I suppose because our pay wasn't all that great. It was better than theirs, but it wasn't enough that you could start throwing your money around.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there a differential left in Canada? Our RCAF pay differential?
There was. Yeah, you're quite right. No. Yes, I guess there was.
You had compulsory saving or whatever they call
it. That is right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Which brought us down
That's right. So the net result was that there really wasn't that much money floating around to put on the dog, so to speak.
Wouldn't be dissension amongst RAF, RCAF, and RAF people.
It never became an issue, and they never did put pay in my particular book. I never did get the figures in there, so. I just, no.
And let me ask you again, while you're still in this training period, some of your first impressions of England.
Well, of course, my parents had come from England, and all my relations, if I had it, what relations I were in England.
Yeah.
I was intrigued with England, probably because it was so much like Victoria. The winters were the same. Well, actually, the winters where we were then, down in the south of England, were the same. The countryside was beautiful. Just beautiful. I liked the pubs. Thoroughly enjoyed the pubs, because it was such a great place for a stranger to go. You walk into a pub in the uniform, and you, particularly a Canadian, at that time, around an airbase, when there were not that many Canadians overseas. What was I say? Two out of my course went overseas. So there were not that many Canadians around. You weren't a stranger more than 5 seconds before someone was buying you a beer. So there was great feeling of the local people, and particularly a place like Abingdon. The village of Abingdon, I think, had a pub for every sort of 40 people. It was it's a place in England where there are more pubs per head than any other town in England. So it was great fun, and I liked the beer. I liked English beer.
Yeah.
So it, I was very taken, and it was some time before I actually got to see my relations, uncle actually, in London, it was some little time, because I just, there was no leave, there was no time off, it was just go.
Yeah.
You were doing, well, you can see the way these dates are falling out. In under 2 months, I was through the OTU, and gone through ground school, 30 hours, roughly 30 hours flying. There was no time off. It was bang, 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 bang.
What about food, Reg?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can remember the food at Abingdon, I thought was atrocious. Again, immediate comparison, because the food in the training schools in Canada was good.
Yeah.
It had all been catered out, and it was done by professional catering people, and it was good. And then the meals on the ship going over, although we ran out of fresh food before the 30 days ran out, nevertheless, it was good food on board that ship. But then to get into a big mess hall and having, I don't know what, the RAF just had no way of training their cooks, it seemed. And what they did to Brussels sprouts was they boiled the outer shells right off them. Just terrible. No, the food was bad, but it got worse. I can remember at one period, a little later, this would be, in 42, I suppose, early 43, by God, breakfast was some fish, and that was it. There was literally no food. We were down to those kind of hard rations. Meat would come up perhaps once every third day or something like this. It was... there was a time when the food, really, it became serious on the squadron. This was 405, because everyone was belly aching like crazy about the food. And I mean, you couldn't blame them, but there was nothing to be done.
Yeah.
They're just, the rations had been cut and cut and cut and cut, to the point where you were down to some pretty basic foodstuffs.
Mm-hmm.
Bread, even the beer was running out. Everything was running out.
Again, I remember in the Army, you got, I forget what it was, a slice or maybe a slice and a half of bread, and period, that was it.
Yes,
you didn't go back
bread.
For a piece of bread.
No, it was all rationed.
Yeah.
Everything was
an
rationed.
Egg was something you saw once a fortnight.
Well, that was the only blessing, as far as Bomber Command was, that normally you were given an egg after when you got back from a raid. They wouldn't give it to you before the raid, you got it when you came back. in case,
save more eggs.
That's right, you didn't want to waste an egg.
If
you got shot. Yeah. So that's the way it went. But the food, I can remember in Abingdon, the food was not very good. And, of course, there were no place to go and eat. The best that would happen would be perhaps a little cafe where you might be able to get fish and chips or something like that.
Beans on toast?
No, they didn't have beans. I don't know. But again, we didn't go out that often because we were kept so damn busy. It was flat out.
Yeah.
Once we got going, they didn't give us time to catch our breath on anything.
You had no air raids?
No.
Yeah.
At least I can't remember any air raids. I don't remember. If there were, it was insignificant. Because Abingdon was some little way outside London.
Yeah.
And by that time, any raids were directed more at London than anywhere else, so it didn't bother us. Although there were, I do remember a couple occasions when there was an alert, but there's a vast difference between alert and being actually under attack. There were alerts. There were alerts all during the war, various stages of various kinds, and particularly when intruders started to come in, and then you had alerts.
Yeah.
But by that time, we were ready for them. There was communications. We had radio and all that sort of thing. Once you got into the operational squadron, of course, it was an entirely different situation to what we had been going through in this operational training with this antiquated equipment that they had.
Well,
but that's the only thing they had. You had to start there with that, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, you're there for 2 months.
Yes, just under 2 months, I guess it was.
Yeah.
August.
So.
Yeah, August left, arrived on, yes, my first flight was August the 24th, and my last flight was September the 15th. So, you see, it's less than 2 months.
Yeah.
At Abingdon. And then... Well, right away, quick. See, I went from there. My last flight was on the 15th, and my I beg your pardon. I'm giving you some wrong dates here. I've got the wrong page. I'm sorry. My last flight was September the 29th. I'm sorry.
That's at the training school.
Yeah, that's at the operational training unit. So I arrived. Yes, it was about 2 months. My first flight was August the 24th, and my last flight was September the 29th.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I gave you some wrong figures on flying time.
We'll
my total flying time when I finished and went to a squadron was 187 hours total flying time. 187.
You only had approximately 50 hours on multi-engine aircraft?
That's right. That's right. That's right. 53 hours.
Yeah.
Yep. On twin-engine aircraft.
That's only the Whitley.
Yes. Yes. That's all. Yeah. Yeah. And I see from here that I was graduated. I was given total flying time. Well, that's total flying time the same. Assessment of ability as a heavy bomber pupil. Not even pilot. Still call it pupil. Average. Signed by K.B.F. Smith, Wing Commander, Chief Instructor, Number 10, OTU. 3rd of October, 1941, which caught up with me later. Well, I suppose it was about the time I left. Because my first flight in my squadron was October the 15th. So I did my last flight on September the 29th.
Mm-hmm.
Packed up, waited for transfer instructions, and then I was flying at my first squadron. Roughly 2 weeks later.
What was your first squadron?
35 squadron. 35.
RCAF or
RAF? No, that was RAF.
RAF,
yeah.
Well, where was that located, Reg?
That was up in Yorkshire.
And what did you have?
Well, this, when we get into the squadron life, again, you go from black and white. Here we left this Abingdon, an old base, old equipment. Oh, One thing I wanted to mention. I remember being overwhelmed by a squadron leader at Abingdon, one of the flight commanders. He had the DSO and the DFC, and it was the first time I had seen anybody with the ribbons. And to have had the DSO and the DFC at that time of the war, and he was a bomber pilot, he was really something. And his name was Jimmy Marks. And I was just a delightful person. God, he was a good-looking man. He was the epitome of everything you'd think of an RAF pilot who had done extremely well. Personality, everything. And the reason why I mention it is that later he was to become a squadron commander, a 35 squadron. So that's why the name sticks in my mind. But I mentioned him because to see, there weren't many ribbons around early, not in bomber command. There had been, of course, the fighter pilots, but we didn't see those. The only time you ever saw any fighter pilots was when you went to London and got into some of the clubs or pubs there.
Yeah.
And there weren't that many ribbons around in bomber command, and to see somebody with a DSO and the DFC, I can remember, was just overwhelming, particularly on a man of that nature. Yes, that early.
Yeah.
He was such a great person. Well, going on to first squadron, I was sent to 35 squadron, which is was at Linton-on-Ouse, just outside York, up in Yorkshire, in four group. Linton was one of those bases that had been built during the late 30s as partly a make-work program, but one of the permanent RAF bases. Excellent facilities. The hangars were all good hangars. The officers' mess was a beautiful. They're still being used today. They were well designed, well laid out, and I think beautiful messes. They had married quarters around. The lawns, the gardens were all beautiful. The gate was a wrought iron gate to come in. You know, it was all done. In those late 30s, when Britain was needed to make work, and of course the beginning of fear of what was happening in Germany.
This is a part of the Horbelicia plan.
That is right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, very much so. And there were a lot of those airfields built. Abingdon actually was one. Abingdon actually had those same facilities, but it was such a crowd. It was an OTU. There wasn't a squadron atmosphere. It was a training school. It was bang, 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 bang. And instructors were up here and people were down here.
Yeah.
But when I arrived at Linton, I was delighted because it was such a lovely base, got there in the early fall. It was superb. Anyway, I checked in, and of course, God, in those days, the rooms were in the mess. I was allocated a room in the mess. Those were 50 officer messes. That's all. And they weren't big, not like they got to be later, but I was given a room and a Batman. I had a Batman who had been in World War One in the RFC, and had remained on after he'd retired as a civilian Batman. And oh, talk about efficient! My God, those men had turn around.
They could look after
you. Look after your bath. Everything was laid out. Anything needed washing or repairing, bingo! It just disappeared and seemed to be back in an hour, and it was all done. Pressing the whole, it was terrific. I felt as if I'd been treated like a king. Because by this time, let's see, I suppose I was still a pilot officer at that time. I don't think I still hadn't reached to become a flying officer. I'm sure I was a pilot officer, as a matter of fact. Yes, I didn't. 42, 22nd of the 6th. Yes, oh hell yes, I was a long way off from being a flying officer, so I still quite long. And to get that kind of a treatment, that's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly one takes to it.
Oh, yeah, oh, I should say. It got even better a little later when we had bat women.
Not really?
Bat men. That became great fun when we had bat women.
Great.
But that's another story.
But
here we were on the base, and the base commander was still living on the base with his wife. And, he didn't have any family, but his wife was there. He had the CO's house. Beautiful home. And they already furnished all their PMQs, and they had the grand piano, the whole nine yards. It was magnificent. And there were two Canadians in the squadron. We arrived about the same time. Another boy, the D.P. McIntyre, Don McIntyre, and myself. There were two squadrons, 35 and 58. And in 58, there was one Canadian, a navigator by the name of White. So on the whole base, the two squadrons, there were just three Canadians. And again, that shows you how early on we're getting, because it wasn't very long before Canadians were almost the bulk of the people in almost any squadron, 25-30%. And here we were, only three in the two squadrons. And the base commander, bless his soul, decided to be sort of look after us, all these young Canadians, and make sure we didn't get into trouble and so forth. And his wife was a charming woman. Used to have us over about once a week for tea, and we had to confess our sins of the previous week as to what trouble we had been in and so forth. This went on for some time until the squadrons began to grow, and the four-engine bombers were just beginning to show up on the scene. So crews were getting bigger, and finally they had to take over the married quarters as accommodation for air crew, because the mess couldn't handle them.
Yeah.
But before getting on to the operations, I'll talk about mess life afterwards. But I arrived, given my room, met my batman, who was there to greet me and get me a
cup of tea.
Oh, the whole nine yards. And showed me the mess, the dining room, and where my napkin would be, and so forth. Mm-hmm. The usual routine of a very polished mess and procedure. And then I got rid of all my stuff. Now I better go down the flight line and check in. And it was, I didn't. I stayed in the mess. I'd gotten in the evening. I stayed overnight, went to bed, got up in the morning, went down to the flight line. And I got down fairly early, walked into the flight office, and to meet my flight commander, who was sprawled across the desk, fast asleep. And so I sort of coughed and then shuffled my feet and so forth. So I didn't know. I thought he was boiled. I thought he'd gone down the office and passed out cold. So anyway, he woke up and apologized immediately and said, "Ah, yes, you're Elaine, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, my name is Cheshire." And I said, "Well, hello, sir." And he said, "I apologize for this." He said, I'm writing a book, and it's called Bomber Pilot. And I have a deadline to meet of about 2 weeks, and I'm trying to get this book finished. And so I'm afraid I worked on it all night, and I fell asleep across the desk. I'm still trying to get this damn thing finished, because my publisher is raising hell with me. And, of course, it was the famous Cheshire.
I'll be dead.
So he was my flight commander. And a delightful person, very pleasant.
Yeah.
Right away, quick, he said, "Okay, we better go flying." And he said, you've never been in a Halifax, have you? And I said, no, never have. And all I've done is, well, you'd have to see my logbook and the usual routine, see what had happened. So he said, all right, come along, and we'll go up in the Halifax. And, of course, now I'm up to four engines. These were Halifax Mark 1s. And again, I was overawed by this bloody great big piece of machinery, and here I am climbing up beside Cheshire, who at that time had not built the reputation that he was, of course, to come out of the war with.
Yeah.
He was a very experienced bomber pilot, but he had not reached the stage of VCs and that sort of stuff. Well, God, he said, have you ever done a formation takeoff in heavy aircraft, in bomber aircraft? And I said, I've never done a formation takeoff, much less one in bombers. And he said, well, let's go. So he said, he called in another one of the pilots. Can't remember his name. Come to me. And he said, let's do a formation takeoff. Now, Linton was a grass field. No runways, just grass. And here we are, four-engine airplane flying off grass field. Well, we taxied out and got lined up for this formation takeoff.
Well, excuse me, do you mean a number of planes taking off?
No, no, just two airplanes. Just two. In a formation takeoff, taking off together. One wing tucked in right behind the other. God, we started to roll. And Cheshire must have been putting a little bit more... Well, he I guess I could be quite blunt and say that his formation flying was bloody awful, but because he started to overtake this other airplane. And we were airborne before the other one, which, of course, should be the complete reverse. Mm-hmm. One should take off first, and then you get airborne. But we took off first, and, of course, once we were airborne, geez, we began to catch up like crazy. So he thought, well, the only thing you can do is chop power. So we pulled all the power off, and we dropped way down, bang, hit the ground, and bounced up again. Well, he kept control of the airplane. And we got air, and then he called for undercarriage up. He told me what the drills were and what I had to do as a second pilot. One of them was to raise the undercarriage, which I did, and then bring up the flaps. And, of course, I was very careful about the flaps. Lesson well learned. And then we went and did a little bit of formation flying, and we were up for, I suppose, about half an hour. And he said, well, let's go. I'll show you a landing. He said, you may as well learn right away, quick, and you got to what's happening. So we went, he said, undercarriage down. And I selected undercarriage down. Jesus, one of the undercarriage wouldn't come down. And, of course, it had been damaged in this when dropping back. Here is a case of where the aircraft had been damaged. Well, to cut a long story short, we did everything. He turned that airplane inside out to try and get the undercarriage to come down by itself and lock into position, but it wouldn't. So finally, he said, well, here we go. So we went in and did a one-wheel landing. One and only time I've ever been in a real prank was with Cheshire on my first flight in a Halifax. Because, of course... He didn't do a belly landing. He did a one-wheel landing, I think hoping not to do too much damage to the airplane. And, of course, as soon as that wing touched, we went around in a few circles. Now, here was a case of where the grass field was ideal because the wheels just skidded on the grass. And, curious enough, very little damage was done to the airplane.
Yeah.
They jacked it up. A couple of props had to be replaced, and the wingtip had to be replaced, and the undercarriage checked out and straightened out, because what had happened was one of the oil legs had bent.
Oy.
And the airplane was serviceable. Yeah. And so it was, but that was my first experience.
I think what we may do, Reg, is leave it there just when you're starting.
Okay,
on the one.
Yeah. All right.
Do you keep in correspondence with Cheshire, by the way?
No, I saw Cheshire... Oh, I saw him several times after the war on various occasions. And the last time I saw him, he had, how would it be? It was somewhere back east. He was up to his eyeballs in these homes, the Cheshire homes. I don't know if you know the story.
Yeah.
Became very religious after the war. And not only religious, but determined to do something to help other people.
Yeah.
And so he started with nothing. He started what are now known as the Cheshire Homes. And he went around begging for money to start these homes for the elderly. And now, almost all through the Commonwealth, there are Cheshire Homes.
Exactly.
Yeah, which he started, and he raised the money. Now I suppose they're self-perpetuating in one form or another. As a matter of fact, I'm not even too sure they're still going, but... He came to Canada, to start one, and I didn't have any success here, primarily because he wasn't really recognized here in Canada. But in England, there were several Cheshire Homes. He went out to Australia, and I don't know what success he had out there. Mm. But he literally did this and spent years and years and years and years doing nothing for a pittance. It wasn't he was literally a pauper doing what he considered to be retribution.
Bless my soul.
Yeah, yeah. What really turned him off was he was on one of the raids. I guess he was on the Nagasaki raid, and he was sent by the RAF down there, and he was so appalled with that raid and the atomic weapon, so appalled that it just turned him right around, and he became the type of person that he still is. He still is. Oh, I could tell all kinds of stories about Cheshire, of course, from my experience with him at 35 Squadron, and having seen him at other times too later on.
How long are you going to be with the 35 Squadron, by the way?
I don't know.
No, but I mean, how long were you with?
Oh, how long was I with it?
Yeah.
I went there again. I can tell you because.
Oh, just offhand, Reggie.
Well, we got there in the fall, October of 1941, and then I finished my first tour at Linton, and then Pathfinders was formed, and Jimmy Marks by this time was the squadron commander, and 35 Squadron was selected as a squadron from four groups. Become the four group squadron in Pathfinders, or what was then to become eight group.
Yeah.
So we moved. The squadron moved. Oh, I had finished my operations. I was screened. I was about to go on into an OTU, and with my past experiences at OTU, I would have do anything to avoid going to an OTU as an instructor. And so I went to Jimmy Marks and I said, "Is there any chance of me staying with the squadron and going on and doing a second tour without the break in between?" And he said, "I don't know." He said, "Certainly, if you want to, I'll see if I can keep you in the squadron." Mm-hmm. Well, the policy was being worked out at that time that if you were in Pathfinders, you could do two tours back to back. And so I was allowed to stay with the squadron. So I went down with 35 Squadron. We moved from Linton down to Gravely in Hunts. A new base, completely new base, and a one squadron base, very limited facility. Nissen huts. To go from Linton to Nissen to Gravely was a real come down. But the only advantage, the only beauty of it was that you were close to London, so you could get to London literally on a train in about an hour and a half, 2 hours, as opposed to that long haul down from Yorkshire. And I stayed there until the spring, I suppose it would be, of 43. So I was with him from October 41 through to, the spring of 43, doing the two tours back to back.
Didn't switch across to 405 RCA.
That came later. That was where I did my third tour. That came later, 405. I had two tours with 35. Yeah. And then went, I was a flight commander in 35, and then when I finished my operations there.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then that's another. Then we'll go on.
So we'll take you. When do we have you next on?
Well, we should get the date straight because
Thursday morning at 9:30.
Yeah.